Yo, yo, yo.
Hey, it's episode 26.
26, we're so old.
This is Ethnically Ambiguous with Anna.
And Shireen. And?
Allie.
He's our guest for today. We're going to get into that a little bit later. We're going to talk about the Dream Act and his experience with that.
And I'm going to talk a little bit about how the U.S. is withholding money from agencies to give to Palestinian refugees and all that good stuff, and why you should not alienate people or push them away or tell them they can't have land, because it will not end well. That's right. I'm going to tell the story of Fatih Sakaki. I probably said that wrong. So stay tuned. Woo.
Who are we? Where do we come from? Who do we become? What is it to be? What to be is it? Where are we? Who are my parents? Where are my pants? Why were we born? We are Ethnically Ambiguous.
Welcome to episode 26. We're 26 years old.
That's not my age.
That's not my age. I always forget how old I am. After 24, it all gets fucked up.
Yeah, I always want to be like, oh, well, it's so wonderful to be 25. And then I'm like,
fuck.
Oh, fuck. I'm aged.
It's episode 26. And this episode, we have a very special person sitting at our table today. It's Sophie, our producer. No, I'm just kidding. There's someone else sitting here, too. And it's a friend that I've known since 2005, since I was 14 in high school. Do you want to introduce yourself?
Hi, everyone. My name is Ali Torabi.
Oh, say it. Ali Torabi.
Esteman is Ali Rezai Torabi.
There you go.
Torabi is actually an Arabic last name. It means from the dirt. And my name is Persian. It's Shireen. It means sweet. I'm not Persian. Ali is—he's not Arab, so we're just all fucked up over here.
I don't mind it. It's a nice and
it's okay. My last name Hosseini.
Very Persian.
Hosseini is also Arab.
Oh, is it?
Yeah,
it is.
That was very wrong.
Hosseini is Arab.
What does that mean? I've never heard of that.
It doesn't translate to anything.
No,
it's just an Arab name apparently.
So we're going to be talking about the Dream Act today, and a little bit about Ali's immigration story and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But do you, Anna, want to talk about what you have brought today first, or should we just jump right into our guest?
You know,
should we just play some catch up?
Yeah, let's catch up a little. My thing is interesting. It's a bit of a murder mystery. It's not really. It's pretty clear what happened, but it's an interesting story. But maybe we
if you girls want to warm up and I can just get used to the
Well, I'll do my story and then we can get into you, and then so you can kind of feel the vibes. Yes, I don't want to go after you too fast, you know.
Yeah, we have to prep you, like marinate the meat
let me warm up into this.
That is sexual harassment.
Okay,
to marinate the meat. I am so sorry, Allie. You feel free to hashtag me too. Okay.
I've known you long enough. I don't mind.
We've known each other.
So, this week, I have not done much. What about you, Shireen?
Since last time, I went to Joshua Tree.
Mm.
I climbed rocks in Santa Clarita. I was an athlete for a day. I shot some music videos. I've been busy. I've been trying to keep myself busy. It's all a lie,
That's
though.
Good.
It's all curated on social media. I'm just curating my life.
It sounds like you are actually doing it, though.
I am, but also, like, I'm still sad inside.
Same. I went to a spa on Saturday of this past weekend, Martin Luther King weekend, and I got to go to, like, a mud club, so I got to, like, cover myself in clay.
I'm so jealous. I saw photos, and I just want to be covered in dirt.
Dude, there is nothing freer than just being like, and then, like, you get to go in a mud pool. It's amazing. Although, then you go in a mud hut.
Is it, like,
hut.
Warm mud? Or, like...
I mean, it's not super warm. It's, like, mud. It's, like, clay. It's mostly clay. Okay. And then you go into a hot... like clay room, so it dries on you, so it just becomes
so you're
super
like a crusty. Cut.
Yeah, so you can like move and your whole body's like...
You're like a living ceramic object.
Yeah, and then you get to go in a mud pool to like wash it all off. And so it's just like this pool of mud that you can't see anything, so you like slip and fall because there's actually like mud on the bottom of it too. It's pretty fun.
Oh, I want to do that.
You can just like throw mud at people. It's not recommended, but...
That sounds fun.
I will.
Yeah, I will.
Actually, me and my friend Abby, we went with. I made like a little clay vagina, and she made a little clay penis that was too big for the vagina. we were having fun, and then we were like, "Oh no, we gotta make the vagina bigger." It was fun. I have fun, and we were the youngest people there by a lot. It was mostly women, and then like straggling husbands who were like.
Like, my wife dragged me here.
I'm at the spa. Yeah. Which, it's nice, though, there's a lot of
they
things
that
are,
they probably pretend
like,
that they don't enjoy themselves, but really they're just like,
dude,
mud,
they just get
dirt.
To go sit in, like, a hot tub.
Yeah.
It's like, you're not dragged here, fool. They give you a robe you get to walk around in. Like, there's, like, saline pools and, like, mineral pools, and they're all, like, hot tubs, basically. And there's, like, those hot and cold pools that you can go back and forth in.
I just was reminded of something. I read our most recent review on iTunes, and it wasn't the greatest review.
I just saw that one, too.
Yeah, about how, like, I don't really like stream of consciousness podcasts.
Yeah, it was, like, straight up, like, my personal preference is not this podcast. It's, like, cool, that's not relevant to anyone else.
She was just like, I really wanted to like it. And I was like, I really wanted you to go away.
Well, the thing is, like, if it's a personal preference that you just don't like how podcasts are structured, like, why leave a review for other people?
She was like, I like the structure more.
It's just more like opinion.
Do you want someone to lecture you? Like
something you're not necessarily unhappy about. It's just not for you. It was weird.
I don't know. So,
look, I'm not opposed to negative reviews. Reviews are reviews. But some of them are just like, if you want to leave a negative one, like... Give me something better, you know? Like, not just, like, personally, I just don't prefer this kind of structure. It's like,
yeah, just
okay.
Like, so, in regards
come
to
come after
that,
me about Israel or something.
Go listen, or go to iTunes and leave a nice review, and then we can shout it out, because I just live for your reviews. And so the other review can just be, like, lost in the clouded stuff. So yeah, you played in mud.
I played in mud, and then I went to a pier, and my boyfriend, what did he do? He time-lapsed a sunset.
Your boyfriend's very into photography.
He's really into GoPros. Time-lapsed the sunset. I'm not making fun of him. It's wonderful. His Instagram is beautiful. Go check
it
out.
Talented.
It's at Exactamundo.
He will sit
in waves for days taking photos of the insides of barrels and then come out like, I can't walk. And it's like, yeah, because you literally just let like 50 waves crush over your body. And you know what? That's like so commendable.
That's like passion. Passion for your art.
And that's the definition of having a white boyfriend. You just go like, oh my God, babe, totally. You did great. And that's it. That's all it takes, baby. All it takes. Figured it out.
Happiness.
Tell every white man everything he's doing. It's just like, babe, that's amazing. And boom, set for life.
It's a good.
That's why my hands are covered in diamond rings. He just loves me, you know? I'm just kidding. It's not that easy.
And is struggling very hard.
I'm like sweating. As usual. And burping.
I'm curious about your murder mystery. Tell me about it.
All right. Today, on episode 26 of Ethnically Ambiguous, I will be discussing... Here's the thing. I'm stalling because I cannot find my document.
Oops. I brought it up too early, guys.
What's my name?
Anna June!
Damn it, where is this, though? Okay, found it. Once again, level of professionalism you can find with Ethnically Ambiguous.
10 out of 10.
I'm going to talk about the assassination of Fatih Shikaki.
Mm. Sounds Persian.
No, just realized the way I said Shikaki.
Shitaki?
Yeah, exactly. I don't... Shikaki. It's S-H-I-Q-A-Q-I.
Shikari?
Shikaki?
I think it's with a Q, but maybe it's a K.
Shikaki. That sounded even weirder.
So who is this man?
So this man is the founder... Oh, excuse me. It's called the Islamic Jihad. Sue me. So Fatih was... You know what? Here, let me start from the beginning. The reason I found this motherfucker is because I, as a bored civilian... was reading about how the Trump administration has decided to withhold millions of dollars from the UN, from a UN agency.
For Palestine.
Called the UN Relief and Works Agency, They're holding about half the money they usually pay for the Palestinian refugees every year. So they're cutting it by more than half. And so it appears they only sent $60 million when they usually send $125 million to the UNRWA. And so they're doing this basically because Nikki Haley's a bitch and she's upset that no one wants to agree that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel because it's not. And so basically, Trump tweeted like, you'll get this money if you agree to peace talks or some bullshit that's been like, you know, on hold for years. Which is understandable because like occupation is like frustrating.
Yeah, of course.
So usually the U.S. supplies the most money. They're like 30% of the relief and works agency's total budget. Mm-hmm. And that money goes to providing healthcare, education, social services to all Palestinians on the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and Jordan and Syria and Lebanon, basically where Palestinian refugees are. Mm-hmm. The UN aid chief, he's asking for donations because, well, you know, the U.S. kind of fucked them. And so now if none of that money goes through that they offered, it's, I don't know, you know, like people are going to lose shit. Like lives are going to be lost. No one's going to be able to eat. Like these people need this money. It's like their last leg to stand on when their whole world was like taken away from them and ripped
like
literally out from beneath
them. How hypocritical is it if you're pulling this money until the Palestinians resume peace talks? Like
it makes literal no sense.
Like that's so cruel. That's so cruel.
Like torturing people for like not wanting to talk about peace because they're just literally being harassed and like kicked off their land every other day.
Like how does that make any sense to anybody? That infuriates me.
No, it doesn't make any sense. So, yeah, the UN chief or the UNRWA Commissioner General Pierre Krachenbull, he said he would like to appeal to donor nations for money and they want to launch a global fundraising campaign aimed to keeping the agency's schools and clinics for refugees open through 2018 and beyond. Of course, Benjamin Netanyahu hates all this shit and he's just like, fuck everybody. Only Israel matters. I spend too much money on personal things. And yeah. So good thing is Belgium countered the U.S. with $23 million to the fund. So
good for Belgium.
Shout out to Belgium for
like,
giving a shit.
There are some whiteys that are good people. I did see that the Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, he railed at Trump in a fiery, like, two-hour-long speech last Sunday. He said, shame on you for his treatment of the Palestinians. And he warned them that he would have no problem rejecting what he suggested would be an unacceptable peace plan.
Yeah, because a peace plan would be like, just give in to whatever Israel wants.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, fuck you.
That's infuriating. So how did you get from there to Mr. Jihad?
How else? 15,000 open tabs. So someone tweeted at the podcast I produce asking like, how can we stop terrorism? Like if the travel ban is not a good thing and all this stuff. And that like made me be like, honestly, there is like no way to stop terrorism because we will never stop like marginalizing people. Mm-hmm. And when you marginalize people, that's what happens. People get upset. They go find a group that accepts them, which is tends to be like a militant terrorist organization. And they're like, dude, we get you. And you're like, cool. And they're like, but take this bomb. And you're like, well, my brothers love me here. So you do it. And that's just the way it goes. That's life because we don't.
And it's also desperation. Like,
yeah,
desperate people will do really the things that they would not have done otherwise.
Yeah. So that led me to Al Jazeera, as usual, and I found a man named Fathi, and here I am today. So this man, he was born in Gaza in 1951, and his family was kicked out before Israel was founded, and he was never able to visit his home or his family, like his refugee family's old home, like ever again. So his family moved to the West Bank and then eventually, after studying physics and mathematics, he went to East Jerusalem to study more. And then from there, he moved to Egypt to study medicine. And so he became a doctor in 1981. And 81 is the same year after he was in the Muslim Brotherhood for a very long time. He became frustrated because he thought the Muslim Brotherhood wasn't, like, basically, like, violent enough towards Israel's and their, like, occupations and all that. So he started his own group called the Islamic Jihad to help, like, be a resistance group
against Israel. In particular.
And so basically what they did, they wanted to create a sovereign Palestinian state within the borders of, like, original Palestine. And, like, while he says he just wanted to, like, liberate all of Palestine, he kind of, like, went a little too far. And by that, it means he was just, like, blowing shit up and having bombs go off. And that basically just made them a terrorist organization.
Yeah.
But, I mean, look, he was trying to do what he was trying to do. The man...
As I said, desperation will lead you to, to things that you would not have done otherwise. Like, you're going to accept help from different places.
Right. So, like, he had a rule that was, like, they were prohibited from killing innocent civilians, and Israeli settlers were an exception of this, which is, like, okay. So, but in the end, like, innocent people were killed by them, and so Israel was, of course, super pissed by this. And then... So... They also worked very closely with Hezbollah, and they received training from the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. So they were getting training from these, like, militant groups. And hey, look, it's still out if the Iranian Revolutionary Guard is a terrorist organization. I'm not going to comment on that. Please don't ask me to comment on that. I have to go to Iran soon. I cannot be held captive for saying something. Look, I'm not above saving my own ass, okay? So don't even ask me to say shit.
I'm quiet.
Yeah, I don't say
quiet
shit.
Quiet as a mouse.
Woo, Iran! What can I say? Great country. Anyway, I know how to save myself.
We're going to snippet that exact audio clip.
Just play
of,
it over
Iran,
and over
country.
And over and
like,
over
look.
Again.
Yeah, just put on as your ringtone. And then when your cell phone goes off in the airport.
And don't worry, I'm not completely blind to what Iran does, okay? I'm fully fucking aware of what they're up to. But, as a brainwashed Iranian child of immigrants who has to go back to that country quite often, I ain't saying shit. So, so they became more and more higher profile because they were just, like, doing more and more shit. Mm-hmm. They're getting up into more shit. And then, so Fatih Shikaki relocated to Damascus in 1990, and he was basically getting the protection of President Syria's Hafez al-Assad, who's, I believe, Bashar's father.
Hafez al-Assad, yeah, he was his father.
Yes, so the operations continued against Israel, and then in 1995, Israel officially claimed that the Palestinian Islamic Jihad was one of their most extreme enemies. And so Shikaki, for most of, like, before he moved to Damascus, he was constantly being arrested and put in jail for, like, bombings and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And he caused he escaped from, or a bunch of these members got arrested, the Islamic Jihad, and they escaped from prison around, like, late 80s. And because of this, this helped lead to the first Palestinian Intifada, which is, like, a huge uprising against the political monster that is Israel. And Shikaki also, I keep calling him Shikaki, and I don't even know if I'm saying that right. He got out of jail, and that's when he basically moved to Damascus in Syria and became a guest of President Hafez al-Assad.
Yeah, and compared to his son Bashar, Hafez is an angel, by the way. Like, I remember when my parents would tell me about Hafez al-Assad, like, he was corrupt, but he was not monstrous like his son, and it's just disgusting. Yeah, never mind. So
right. So in Damascus, this is when he planned the most, like, devastating attack called the Beit Lid attack. And this was, they, like, bombed an area that just had a bunch of Israeli soldiers in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, a bunch of them died. And that was, like, basically when Israel was like, this is going to end right now. So that's when they started basically planning his assassination. And they couldn't kill him in Damascus. Like, Israel in Damascus committing, like, an assassination would have just gone so poorly. Like, it would just end up with more people dying because, like, Syria was just not having Israel killing people in it.
Yeah.
And so in 1995, Shakaki, he was on a trip back from visiting the Libyan president, Muammar Gaddafi. And on his way back, he stopped in Malta and he checked into a hotel. And in less than 5 hours, he was dead. So
in Malta?
In Malta. And the Maltese officials, they investigated the death and they couldn't figure out who did it.
How did he die?
He was, well, I'll get into that. So, but real quick, Mossad won't admit they did it, even though it was 100% Mossad did it. They said maybe Libyan officials did it because, you know, it was maybe their secret service who were annoyed with him or something from Gaddafi. Cause I guess there was some like tense relationship between Gaddafi and the Islamic Jihad group. So they can't confirm who killed him. He was shot in the head 6 times at point blank range, which is a signature of Israel assassins called the Kidon, with a pistol fitted with a silencer to, and the device to catch the spent cartridges. So they basically couldn't find any of the cartridges to explain who shot him. Mm-hmm. It was very, very well planned, obviously. And he died instantly.
Yeah,
and so he had a funeral in Damascus on November 1st, 1995, and was attended by almost 40,000 people.
Holy shit.
So this guy actually, like, he was quite legendary in what he did for his fight against Israel. The route he took of bombings and all that and basically becoming a terrorist organization, not supported. Wouldn't recommend doing that. But that's just kind of the point I was trying to make is if you push people enough, they will react. And that's how these things are born. It's like you are taking money away from people who have already had so much taken away
from
them.
They have nothing left. It's just,
you're asking for trouble.
Yeah.
You can't now just be like, well, I'll agree to our peace talks. It's like no one is thinking about peace anymore. People are just being like, hi, I need to eat. I need to like feed my children. I need to be able to go to school. I need to do something so I can get out of like this life I'm in.
Yeah. Israel and the U.S., they create these terrorist organizations themselves, like what they call terrorist organizations. It's, they lead people to the most desperate circumstances, and then they get surprised and outraged when those people fight back. They're as if like they should just roll over and die.
Well, yeah, that's basically how insurgents are born. Like the more people you like fuck over, their family members get upset and turn to a dark side.
Man. Yeah. That was interesting. What did you think about that, Ali?
I think you're correct in saying that people get pushed to do things that they normally wouldn't do.
Yeah.
That probably at some point in their life they would consider uncharacteristic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but when people are put in circumstances where they feel like it's a, I don't want to say fight or flight, but like they feel like survival's on the line, they tend to do things that
are extreme.
That are very extreme.
Yeah.
You know, and I try not to get too much into topics of this nature. Especially the circumstance I'm in, I have to.
For sure.
I have to be a law-abiding citizen.
I did have a lot
level.
Of questions about that. I have so many questions about that.
I can't necessarily.
Let's get into you a little bit. So you're a recipient of DACA.
Yes.
Tell the listeners what DACA is.
Okay, so I am a DACA recipient, and DACA stands for Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, and it is an executive order that was implemented in 2011, 2012, and it is an order that allows immigrant youth that were brought here prior to a certain year, I think it was around 2009 or 2007, I don't know the exact thing, but who have graduated from high school, have no criminal record, who are working, who are in school, and they're law-abiding, no misdemeanors, nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Then they give you the opportunity to legally work and get a driver's license.
Okay.
Those are the two fundamental things. And so that, it's a very helpful, helpful thing, especially when you live in the shadows for so long, like so many of my DACA brothers and sisters have, you know, including myself. You know,
so you immigrated here from Iran.
Yeah, I moved here from Iran back in 1995 with my brother and my mother.
Mm-hmm.
And we came here legally and without, you know, like Anna said, there's certain things you don't say.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Being from Iran, you got to be a little careful. Granted, I have not been back to Iran in 22 years. I hope that one day I will be able to go back to Iran.
Because your father is there.
My father is there. My whole family on my mom's side is there.
Wow.
I have a sister in Iran who I know through WhatsApp, whom I've never met.
Wow.
And many cousins and...
Do you know why your mom took you and your brother and left?
Yes. Well, my mom's side of the family is here. My uncle came here. My mom's brother, my mom is, 65. Her brother's just a little bit younger than him, but he is the second oldest male in our family on my mom's side. And he came here in 70s, right around the revolution, right before the revolution, for school.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And he came here and he was fortunate enough. At that time, it was very different. It was prior to 9/11. It was prior to a lot of different immigration.
It was prior to 1979, before the revolution.
Prior to that, exactly. So it was a lot easier to get your paperwork here. So my uncle was able to get legal residency, get his green card, and eventually apply for adjustment of status to get his citizenship. And once he was able to do that, he was able to obviously bring his immediate family.
Right.
My grandma, his mom. And so I'm in a mixed status family, where all of my uncles and aunties and cousins on my mom's side are citizens.
Yeah.
So my mom was, that's what we thought. Eventually we come here, we'd be able to go to school, and she'd be able to get her citizenship. We get our citizenship, and so that's how it was. That's what the original plan was. It's just my mom decided to come a little later because, she got married a little later. She had us a little later.
Yeah.
She had a good life in Iran. My mom was a business owner in Iran. She had a salon. She owned apartments. She owned land. My mom did work in Iran.
Yeah. Independent working
woman. She was especially in Iran at that time, for her to do that, is extremely impressive.
Yeah.
She always jokes with me because my brother right now, if he hears this, he's going to get a little angry at me. Not angry, but he'll laugh at me. He invests in cryptocurrencies.
That's the hot thing to do right now.
So he makes a little bit of money. And so he always jokes with my mom. He's like, yeah, you see how much money I'm making? I'm this age and I'm making this much money. My mom looks at me, he's like, man, when I was your age, I worked 1 year, I bought two apartments and land. Don't come at me about making money. So, we came here basically my story is no different than most immigrants.
Right.
Why did we come here? Why did your family come
for
here?
A better
Why did
life.
Anna's family come? Yeah. We came here for a better life, for a better education, for opportunities, and that's a lot of, I want to say 90% of the reason I'm here. It's just, we were unfortunate in our circumstance that we had an attorney that was not the most honest practicing immigration law attorney.
What do you mean?
He went in the middle of our case, fabricated some information, and my mom doesn't speak English, so you kind of just have to adhere to what the attorney says to you and kind of just hope that they have your best interest in mind.
Right.
So they fabricated some information, and within the courts, it was revealed. And my mom just really believed what this guy was trying to do, what he's going to do. She said, do whatever you need to do, right? So we got to a point where we almost were handed down a frivolous case. And in the United States, if you get a frivolous case, you can never, without government getting involved, you can't get any status in the country. So we got to that point, and then they told us, we're not going to let you get your green card, and we actually need you to leave.
Okay.
Yeah, and at that point, because of this attorney and because of the case, how it played out.
Yeah.
So, at that point, we were already here for a couple of years, and my mom made a decision that she gave up a lot to come here. She sold her business, she sold her some of her land, and she decided that there was more opportunity for my brother and I here than in Iran.
Yeah.
And Anna, you know how Iran is. There's a lot of things that go on.
Yeah.
As a result of sanctions, as a result of...
People lost land, people lost businesses.
And people get involved with a lot of things. I've had family and family friends that get involved with drugs at a higher rate than they would do so here.
It's just a tougher way of life.
It is. It really is. And so my mom made that calculated decision.
To stay here.
To stay here.
Illegally.
At that point, I guess you could be considered... It's just, for me, the concept. It's just a concept of like being illegal. It's such a weird concept to me being is an illegal person.
It's really absurd. Yeah.
But yes, if you want to look at it that way, we stayed here
against what the court said.
Court orders to some extent. Yeah. So, for the longest time, I didn't really notice. Like, I knew I didn't have my green card, but you don't really notice.
Yeah, no one really asks you in middle school. Yeah.
You don't need to work. Yeah. You don't need to drive. You don't need to do anything. It wasn't until I got into high school and my friends started working. And I was like, oh, I want to start working. And I go and ask my auntie. She's like, oh, just wait. It's okay. You don't need to work. And I'm like, okay, I guess not.
Yeah.
And then my friends start driving. And these are little things, you know, but they start compacting, right?
Yeah.
And your friends start driving and... And I'm like, well, I want to start driving. My auntie's like, you can wait on that too. And I was like, okay, I guess.
Something's fishy going on.
I was like, okay, I can wait on that. You know, and I knew, I was like, there's got to be, you know, I realized that I couldn't get my paperwork. You know, I mean, couldn't get a driver's license. I couldn't work. And I kind of live with it. And out of fear, you know, they tell you, don't tell anybody your status. Don't tell anybody what's going on. You know, they could come after you. And you know, when you're young, and you're in high school and you're going through a process of like figuring out who you are as a human being, what you want to do. It's this added element of uncertainty and fear that kind of gets in the way of you really figuring a lot about yourself out.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a lot of that going on in high school.
Yeah.
Not to an overwhelming extent because, you know, we went to high school together.
Yeah, for
you
sure.
know, I was one of the cool kids there.
We had a lot. I mean, every high school kid goes through shit, you know? But like,
exactly.
I think that there's an added element that you have to keep hidden almost.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And you know, in high school, I was fine. I didn't have problems. You know, I did my thing. I went to school and I lived next to campus, so I didn't need to drive.
Mm-hmm.
I walked there. You came to my house a couple of times.
Yeah,
we walked over.
Delicious Persian food.
So, and I walked there, so I didn't need to drive. You know, I did little things at the house and I got little allowances and this and that. And I managed, you know, it wasn't until I got out of high school. And I'll tell you what, like when I was going through high school, I just never really like thought about school, university, this, that. I just never thought I could go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't apply for school. I didn't like take SATs. I didn't do any of these things, you know, because I was just under the pretense that those are things that I'll never be able to do.
I have a question. When did you start to realize? Did you know all along that
I didn't have paperwork?
Yeah,
I knew at a very early age. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. But it's just when you're young and not having that piece of paper or green card
really,
or citizen,
really
it doesn't directly affect you because you know.
You don't understand.
If you're not driving, you're not driving. When you get into circumstances where it starts directly affecting you. And when it really started affecting me is when I got out of high school.
Yeah.
And then I was in a community college. And I got serious with school. I did well. I started getting straight A's. And I started thinking about, okay, maybe I can transfer. And then you look into it and you're like, well, no, I can't transfer. You know, I had to apply for AB 540, which made me a person who at that point had lived in the United States for like 14 years in San Diego, specifically 14 years. I had to apply for AB 540, which would allow me to pay in-state tuition in the state and the city, which I've lived for 14 years.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And that's not a big deal. I did that, but I couldn't get any financial aid at all.
Yeah.
And I don't come, you know, not that my family is giving me everything, but we've come under hard times like a lot
for
of other
sure,
families, especially after the recession.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I could have like scrounged some money together and had my uncle get a second mortgage on his place and my auntie get a mortgage on her place and this and that and tried to go to school. But I didn't. I was not going to do that. My family sacrificed enough for me. I was not even under the pretense that I would do anything like that. So I couldn't transfer. You know, I got stuck in community college for a very long time. You know, I finished up after the first year and a half. I had all the units I needed to transfer.
Mm-hmm.
And I was stuck. I felt like, you know, it's such a weird concept of like, you literally, in this country, people talk about so much freedoms you have and so much this and so much that. I felt so limited. I felt so stuck.
Yeah.
You know, and granted, don't get me wrong. Like, I don't regret anything. I am so glad. Before I go on, I just want to make it clear to anybody that's listening. I am so glad that I went through what I did.
Yeah.
I am so glad that I did not have my paperwork. I am so glad that I had the experiences I had because literally they define who I am now. They've interwoven themselves into the fabric of my being, and I have no regrets about that. It's just I've gotten to a stage now where I've learned enough.
Yeah.
I've developed enough. I'm ready to get some paperwork so I can, you know, not be so limited.
Yeah.
But, you know, when I was in community college and I started thinking about transferring and I started thinking about I really need to make money, you know, and when you're undocumented, you kind of have to do things a different way. You know, I ended up having to work at a Persian restaurant under the table, get paid less than minimum wage or around minimum wage. You work. I kid you not. I used to show up there in the morning at 8 o'clock And sometimes I would leave at 2 a.m.
Whoa,
I was doing 16, 17 hour shifts sometimes, and I would come right back. I go home real quick, sleep, and I'd be right back. And they know you're in that position and you can't say anything.
Yeah, you can't.
They tell you come at work, you're going to work
seven days a week. And they know
that
you can't say no.
You need the money.
Yeah.
You know, I dropped out of school for a while because I was doing that. You know, and I remember because I paint, I do murals. So
you're a really good artist. I remember. Yeah.
I'm decent. I've done a couple of paintings here and there. But point being, like, this guy knew that I painted, and I did do a mural. That's how I met him. I did a mural at his restaurant, and he brought me into work afterwards. And then everything he needed, every little painting he wanted, every little, like, I literally, like, the guy had me go and paint the restrooms.
Wow.
For like $8 an hour. I was
That's
like,
so fucked up.
Wow. Kinda, and this, I was just sitting there like, and I was like, you know what? I'd rather paint than do dishwashing.
That's true, I guess. Yeah.
But I mean, this, like,
when
it's
you
just,
think about that, it's kind of upsetting that they will take advantage of you that way.
Oh, 100%. And you know, in me, my situation is not even that bad. Like, you know, I'm fortunate on some level that I'm from Iran, and America and Iran don't have good relations. So, you know, they can't,
They're not going to be like,
no,
go
amnesty.
Back to home.
There's no amnesty. I'm not amnesty.
What's the word?
Extradition.
They have no like relations.
Asylum.
They don't have a. There's no buildings.
Yeah.
What do you call it? American
embassy.
Embassy. Yeah. What am I saying?
Well, there's one embassy for Iran in D.C. and it's in like the Mexico embassy.
Well, I'm saying then there's not one in Iran, right?
No.
There's no.
You gotta like leave Iran, go to Dubai to do it.
So right now, currently, how did you get involved in the DREAM Act?
And so the reason I got involved is,
first explain what the DREAM Act is, just so people aren't aware.
Well, okay, before I explain the DREAM Act, I just kind of want to we were talking about the DACA and I kind of got on a tangent, but I just, when DACA passed at that point, it really put me in a position where I could literally finally start living my life. I got my driver's license. I started working normally, got some respect. I transferred to UCLA.
And DACA passed in
2012. Yeah.
Okay.
So first the California Dream Act passed, which allowed me to get some private loans and state loans and state funding. So that allowed me to transfer. I transferred to UCLA, you know, and finally got to go to school there.
Amazing.
I graduated top of my class, you know. And before that,
real quick, what did you major in?
I majored in anthropology.
Which is
Allie. Not the most the Iranian parents.
Yeah, I mean, knowing you from high school, it makes sense, but it doesn't make sense as far as like.
Yeah. But I tell you what, you know, like I was fortunate enough that, you know, I am pre-med. I took all the pre-med classes. I'm in my med school interview process, and I've interviewed at like Georgetown and Duke and a couple other schools. So it's like I just did something that I enjoyed while still putting myself
in
a position
that
I can
move,
go out loud.
Yeah.
I kind of wish I did painting. I'm not gonna lie. I loved anthro, but
well, you should have done painting, man.
I know, I should have.
No regrets. Don't remind me.
So
I don't think you physically could have done painting. There's so much in your Iranian blood that's like, I can't do it.
I am
mindful to not let that overtake who I am.
That's good.
I am very conscious in not letting that.
So you became a driver's.
I got driver's license. I got DACA recipient, and can you guys hear me? Okay, there we go. We came back. So I remember I got to UCLA, and I'm not going to name any names or organizations. And even then, I still had some limitations. Like, I remember I was trying to finally start volunteering in hospitals, and I went to a specific hospital.
Yeah.
And I had already interviewed, and I got through the interview process, and I got the position at this hospital, and I finally got in to go fill out my final paperwork. So I done all my shadowing there, and I went to the lady that was supposed to finish up my paperwork, and she's trying to do a background check on me. And at that time, I still hadn't got my license. You know, the California Dream Act has passed, but I hadn't utilized the DACA yet to get my license and everything.
Right.
So I went over there, and I was like, look, okay, I've done my 1 month of volunteering/interviewing, and now I'm ready to finally start, get my badge, get everything. And the lady looked at me, she's like, oh, can I get your driver's license? And I was like, oh, I'm in LA. I'm in UCLA. They understand. They're progressive. And I told her my situation, and she kind of looked at me like she was shook.
Yeah.
She looked at me like, and she's like, how did you get through the process? Da, 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 da. And I'm like, what do you mean? How did I get through the process? She's like, how does someone like, in your circumstance, I got to go talk to the interviewers and da, da, da. And I was like, what are you talking about? You know, I was like shook. I was like, I couldn't believe that that was still at this stage. So I couldn't get involved in the program. And she told me like, when you fix your things and you can come back. And she looked at me like I committed a crime. I'm literally here trying to volunteer my time for free.
Yeah.
For free, you know, to do things for free in your hospital and you're treating me like I'm some sort of criminal.
Bullshit,
and that's the reality of like what people went through. And like I said, my situation, again, I've had it relatively good. You know, the only area, the only thing, and I was kind of debating if I should bring this up, but there's one area that really hit me hard. It hit my family hard. And it was when, because at the time I was looking at Berkeley and UCLA and I was trying to figure out where I wanted to go. And I was up in Berkeley for a little bit. And I get a call from my auntie and she says, where are you at? And I was like, oh, I'm in Berkeley, still up here. And she's like, okay, just if you can, don't come home for a little bit.
Oh.
I was like, what do you mean don't come home for a little bit? They're like, yeah, you're, I don't want to scare you, but they got your mom. And I'm like,
oh my God.
What does that mean? Who's got my mom and what does that mean? So the immigration ICE had detained my mother.
What the fuck?
And they had put her in jail, in the detention center. For 6 months, my mom was in jail.
Are you serious?
And they were looking for me, you know, and they were looking for my brother. My mom has not done a single thing to anyone. No, never committed a single crime. Well, because we have that order out for for us, right? After the court order, we overstayed.
Yeah. Where was your brother at this time?
I'm not 100%. He was in San Diego, but I think my auntie called him and he ended up going elsewhere. My mom was in the process of trying to get her green card, and they keep, you know, this is a funny, you know, question you get all the time. I hear it from a lot of people that are unfamiliar with the situation. They're like, well, you've been here 22 years. Why haven't you gotten your green card yet? Why haven't you applied? I'm like, because if it was that easy, right?
I have so many uncles that have gone through similar things, and it's not easy at all.
After 1979, America had no interest in Iranians at all.
No.
Trying to get green cards.
We apply and we give.
So what happened?
But point being that, so
6 months?
6 months. 6 months they had her there, and I couldn't go. I couldn't see her, obviously, because they're looking for me. And I played it safe. But that was like such a wake-up call for me. You know, like in that moment, I was like, I've done nothing wrong in this country.
Yeah.
My mom's done nothing wrong in this country. You know, even, they create this narrative of like,
Your existence is a crime, almost.
Like, my mom did something wrong coming here.
Yeah.
And they started this initial narrative when they were trying to pass the DREAM Act, which the DREAM Act is a bill that we're trying to get on the floor. And now they're calling it the USA Act, which would give us a route towards permanent residency and citizenship. And the GOP is, like, dangling that over us right now hostage because they want their border wall and they want their border patrol. And I'll get to that. Yeah. I'll get to that. But it's they created this narrative like immigrants are the act of immigrating here is a criminal act.
It's,
you know, like
it's so wrong.
As if a piece of paper defines your value, as if an immigration path defines who you are.
Right.
You know, not the dignity of your character, not your morals, but a piece of paper literally has come to give us value.
Yeah.
As DACA recipients, and that's what's tied in. With, you know, like I was in DC last week meeting with congressional members. And I was fortunate enough to meet some people from my own district, Peters, and a few other people that are in Southern California. And I met with Kamala Harris and a few other people. And Kamala is very nice. She's very supportive. She's a strong advocate of the community. But it's just this notion of like we're like walking around and telling our stories to people to like kind of make them feel bad for us or our stories resonate with them so they vote with us. And it's just like, it's such an interesting thing that we're in 2018 and we're sitting here like, hey,
trying to convince people
I have rights too.
Yeah,
I'm a human being. I've been here 22 years. There's some people that came here when they were 1 year old. There's a couple people in my group that came here. That's their home, you know? And they're 30. They've been here 20. It's just such a weird concept. 29 years here and they're still begging for the rights that their peers have. The same people that we went to elementary, middle school, high school with, the same kids I played football with, the same kids I went to prom with, the same kids that I went to college with. I fell in love in this country, you know. I had my heart broken in this country, you know. Yeah. There's very few things that differentiate me from my peers.
Yeah.
Everyone has differences, obviously.
No, I know exactly what you
but
mean,
it's
though.
Other than that piece of paper. Yeah. So that's what, you know, and when DACA got rescinded on September 5th, I kind of got complacent. I'm not going to lie. I had my situation kind of settled, right? Like I was like, all right, I'm going to get into med school. I can get some funding. I can, you know, I can do my thing. And then when they rescinded DACA, this very anti-immigration administration that we have right now, they rescinded DACA. I just remember thinking to myself, like, how much DACA gave to me. It allowed me to come out of the shadows. It allowed me to finally not be afraid have some stability, even though it was like a pseudo stability. Every 2 years, you have to renew DACA and pay $500 every time you renew.
Right.
It gave me some sense of normalcy. And then it just pulled that right away. You know, like I had just finished up all my secondaries for med school on September 5th. They rescinded DACA and I was just sitting there like, man, I just paid a couple $1,000 for all these applications.
Yeah.
Like, what's the point? What's going to happen? Can I even go to school? And then I got very fortunate. The next day, Georgetown sent me an interview and I just was like, I think, I don't know if it was like a protest interview invite, because I thought the irony of it that I was going to be a few blocks away from Pennsylvania Avenue interviewing for med school while this guy's telling us that like these immigrants, these rapists and terrible terrorists that are coming this way. And I'm like, all right, if that's what you want to consider me.
Yeah.
Hopefully you don't get sick and you show up, you know, where I'm at.
Yeah.
Not that I would help you still.
Yeah.
Because I have dignity.
Yeah.
You know, but I once that happened, I just thought to myself, there's a whole generation of youth that are going to have that same feeling of anxiety and that same feeling of uncertainty that I had for so long, and they will not have the opportunity to relinquish themselves of that the way I did through DACA.
Right.
There's a whole generation of kids that are going to not have the same chances I had to go to my dream school, to work, to give back to my community. You know, in the way that I am, like, I work with the UCSC student-run free clinic, which is the UCSC School of Medicine's clinic. I'm a floor manager there. I work with Reed San Diego, where I help with adult illiteracy. I was, right as soon as this event happened, when it rescinded DACA, I started working with Alliance as a human rights organizer. We started a thing called the San Diego Border Dreamers. I've done a lot of things for my community. You know, and I'm very committed to the community that has played an integral role in who I am. And all I want to do is continue to give back to my community, continue to give back to the most vulnerable amongst us, the disadvantaged, the underserved.
And they probably feel so isolated and alone, even more like an alien than they already are. You know what I mean?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And I said, I will not stand any longer. And I know I'm at risk. I know I have certain things that are tied in with my immigration status that puts me at risk if I come out and advocate. But what platform I have, I want to utilize it to advocate to the best of my abilities for those that don't have a voice, for those that can't come up, for those, the younger generation before me that will never experience DACA. And I said, you know what? If you don't get to experience DACA, I'm going to give you one better. I'm going to fight for the Dream Act.
Yeah.
I'm going to make sure that you have a route towards permanent status, that you don't have to worry every 2 years what's going to happen if they're going to get rid of this executive order. Your normalcy and your stability of mind won't be dependent on some anti-immigrant administration.
Right. So that's what
I'm doing now.
What can we do to support the Dream Act?
So what you could do, and what everyone can do, and anyone that's listening, is there's a lot of things you can do, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you can, when we have these events where we are standing against certain congressional members and telling them, look, keep us in mind when this spending bill, because now, like, if I can, we're going to get into a little bit of the politics of it, right? So this is where the complexity really comes out, is we have this situation where we're trying to pass the Dream Act, and we had a chance in 2010 to pass the Dream Act.
What happened?
And I want to tell anybody that's a Democrat out there, anybody that's listening, I want everybody to know that we don't have a short-term memory. I know that's a culturally common thing in America where people, something happens and we forget about it in 2 weeks.
On to
the next one. Mass shooting happens 2 weeks later. On to the next one. So we haven't forgotten in 2010 when you guys had the House, the Senate, and the presidency, and you had a chance to pass a Dream Act, a standalone Dream Act. Maybe it had some port involved in it, but there was no border wall tied in. There was no militarization of the border. There's no 15,000 additional border patrol agents. And you guys didn't pass that because five Democrats voted against it. We didn't forget that. And now we're sitting here and saying, you guys don't have the House, the Senate, or the presidency.
Fuck.
And you're telling us, like, don't worry, we're going to get this done for you. I appreciate the support, but it's a little, it's like 8 years too late for me.
Yeah.
And the things that you're offering in the USA Act, you're telling us that it's going to be 12 years to a potential route to citizenship.
Ugh. Damn.
And then on top of that, we can't file for our parents.
Yeah.
What the fuck, man?
I have no desire. My mom sacrificed, and so many of my DACA brothers and sisters sacrificed so much to bring us here. So much. You know, to bring us
everything.
Here. And you're asking me to turn around and ask my mom and ask my fellow brothers and sisters to ask their parents to make one more sacrifice? I'm not going to concede that on any capacity. There's a certain point in your life where the roles change. Those that took care of you you have to stand back and kind of consider how you're going to take care of them.
Mm-hmm.
Those that sacrifice for you, you have to take the role and sacrifice for them. And that's where I'm at now. My roles are changing. I have to consider my mother and how much she did for me and how much she sacrificed for me, you know, and it's my turn to take care of her. It's my turn to put myself at risk if it need be, if it helps my community, if it helps my family. And that's what I'm doing now, you know. And
yeah.
It's meeting with congressional members. It's calling them and letting them know the value that us as DACA recipients bring to this community. It's almost like, I don't know how to explain it. Like when you're an immigrant, and especially when you're an undocumented, you have to be not just better, you almost have to be perfect.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
the smallest blemish, they put it on under a microscope and mm-hmm. they amplify
and
it.
And they'll use it against you.
And they use it against you.
Yeah.
And it's okay. Look, it's not like every single person has to be a doctor or a lawyer or a PhD candidate. Look, people can be workers too.
Mm-hmm.
But they bring value in a different way, right? They bring value in terms of their work ethic. They bring value in terms of the dignity of their characters.
They enrich
these
the
things are important too. And they talk about America, the land of the free, the American dream. They talk about
Most
how America.
People love America more than probably. Mm-hmm.
It's
people
unbelievable
that are
their commitment
here
to this
for
country.
For that reason.
And solely for that reason.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable how much some of these people are so committed, how American they consider themselves, but they're considered less American because of a piece of paper. These people literally will give up everything they have for this country.
Yeah.
You know? And they talk about American is an ideology. It's not a race. It's not an ethnicity. It's an ideology. It's an ideology of an income-passing country
mm-hmm.
where people come in and acclimate and contribute just a little bit of their culture and their ideologies.
Mm-hmm.
And all these things come together. Find me another place in the world that has so many different cultures, so many different ideologies. And on most times... working harmoniously, right?
Yeah.
There aren't too many other places. Maybe you got England, maybe a little bit of Australia, but that's what it means. I mean, when you think of America and the ideology of America, and they're trying to strip us of that. This current administration, this current environment we're in, they're trying to strip us of that ideology. And I'm telling you, and I'm telling everybody that's listening and everyone that will listen to me, that we bring value to our communities in the same way that our peers do who are natural born citizens. If anything, because we know we're behind the eight ball, we work harder. We work twice as hard. We have to be perfect. And we understand that. We don't have a problem with that. We're not asking for handouts.
Mm-hmm.
We're not asking you to give us anything.
You're asking for equality. You're asking for the same. Yeah.
That's it. That's all we want. Just a chance for me to go to med school, for my brother to go to med school, for my friends to become nurses and physicians and attorneys, for people to just to work, for people not to worry that if they go home and they come back and they're families aren't separated because their mothers got detained.
I can't even believe she was there for 6 months.
And the crazy thing is I have friends who've had their parents deported. Literally, I can give you an instance with one of my really good friends. Her uncle, who was going to work at 5 a.m, ICE was going around and they were looking for a certain somebody, but because it's a predominant Hispanic area, they couldn't find the person they're looking for. So they asked her uncle, "Where's your papers?" He said, "What do you mean, where's my paper? Why are you asking me that?" Eventually, one thing led to another. They deported him back to Mexico.
The fuck?
And did he have papers?
He did not have papers, unfortunately. But the reality
is... he was going to work at 5 a.m.
He was going to work
at
5. This is a hardworking individual, right?
Yeah.
And this is the reality. Like, this is what... And when I was in D.C., I had the chance to meet with 120 different DACA recipients from across the nation. And because they're from the Midwest or different parts of the United States, they don't necessarily understand the reality of what it means to be in a border town. So I had to tell them, like... it's different in San Diego. When you're having these conversations with these congressional members, keep the most vulnerable amongst us in mind. When you're having these dialogues and they're telling us, hey, what are you willing to concede? Do not concede the well-beings of our brothers and sisters' families, especially the border town people, where you put us in a position where we have to pick between our futures and our family, our support systems. You know, where they want to increase the number of Border Patrol agents, which last time they did it was in 2001 after 9/11. There's 15,000 surplus of Border Patrol agents who were untrained, unqualified, that had no right being in such a sensitive job, where there was a huge uptick of violence at the border, where
so
people were
stupid.
Gun violence and things like that.
Yeah.
People that are dying that should never have, because these are very unqualified people going into the border. That's such a sensitive job to have. You can't just hire anybody.
No, of course
you know,
not.
And they're planning on doing that again with the added benefit of border militarization and their wall. And their wall, this is the...
And they make all this bullshit so, like, this idea that it's patriotic or something.
Oh, my goodness.
It's such fucking BS. But no, I'm so glad that we brought you on to talk about this stuff, because... I just thought it would be more beneficial than me reiterating your story if you just told us it right.
No, and I absolutely appreciate you ladies bringing me on. I think the only way we get through these things is having a dialogue, breaking down the stereotype of what it means to be an immigrant, because there's this idea of what it means to be a DACA recipient. I've spoken
even the word illegal. You were like, as we mentioned before, like it just sounds like you committed a crime.
Yeah,
like
how is a human being illegal?
It's just absurd. Yeah,
it's like they objectify us like we're some sort of object that can be, I guess, smuggled across the border.
That's
or flown
crazy.
Over.
Like, borders are literally made up. They mean nothing.
Yeah.
Artificial, exactly. Yeah.
Exactly. I have a question. So how did your mom get out of detention then?
So because of, like I said, Iran and America don't have relations, so I guess
they weren't
going to
deport her.
They couldn't deport her. Mm. They could detain her and...
Honestly, that happened with my uncle. He had something, I won't mention, I'm not going
to
say which uncle,
details,
but he, something happened
Shout
with his papers, and they can't, they're waiting until things cool down in Syria so they can send him back, basically, because there's a war going on.
It's unprecedented.
And it's, he's just biding his time and trying to figure out something to do, but like, because they're, I mean, I guess they have a little shred of humanity, if that's the case. You know what I mean? Like, they're not going to send him to a war-torn country, but they're still, it's fucked up because he's been here and working and, it's...
I mean, look, this is like a reality that takes place across the whole world. I was driving here and I was hearing about the Rohingya from Myanmar, where they're thinking about sending him back already.
What?
Like, in the next month. And I'm like...
To what?
To Buddhists who want to kill them.
It's unprecedented.
Oh, God,
you know,
man.
And this is what I'm saying. Like my reality is bad, right? On some levels. But again, I have no regrets because I've learned a lot from him. But the reality of my DACA brothers and sisters who are from Mexico or from Central America and South America,
I mean, it is far
worse. And that's why, you know, they told me, you know, when I worked at a certain place, I spoke to an attorney that told me, look, under your circumstances, I would suggest that you shouldn't go out and talk,
because
if they find out about your situation, they could target you, they can throw you in the detention center and let you out, throw you back in, let you out.
I mean,
if you make enough noise.
At least you know they're not going to really send you to Iran, right?
But they could mess with me, right?
They could mess with me. But I applaud your bravery and using any kind of platform you have for this purpose, because how else are we going to know about it? Like, you know what I mean? Like, our listeners probably... I would want them to know about it firsthand.
And this is what I'm saying. Like, this is the only way to do it. You break stereotypes. Like, I've had so many people come up to me and they're like, they find out I'm DACA and they say to me, "Hold, you're DACA? But your English is so good." And I'm like, it's like they have no idea. Like, they have no idea. And the only way they find out is if we come out and tell our stories.
Yeah. No, we had a guest on a couple weeks ago, Marcella Arguello, and she was saying that her brother, his high school friend found out that he was here, like, without papers, and he stopped being his friend. Like, it was just like he had, like, it's like, some people are so close-minded, and so, do you remember that whole thing?
Yeah, definitely. He, like, lost a friend because after all these years, he found out his true colors when
that's
just
a good loss,
he realized he was.
I gotta say, that's a good loss, though, if you want, you don't want
no,
a friend
yeah,
like that.
No, yeah, it's true colors, and it's, you want people around that see you for who you are and not for some, I don't know, political prop or something. I don't know. It's just...
I feel so bad for, like, these like, for me, I consider myself... I've been going through this for a little while, and I'm a little callous to it.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I'm, like, seasoned. I'm a little callous to it. Like, I don't let it...
That's understandable.
Really emotionally.
Understandable.
But these kids that, like, every day we're looking at Congress, and Trump comes out and says, like, 4 months ago, him and Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, like, oh, we got a deal for the DACA people. And then he's like, no deal for the DACA people. And then he comes out, like, even last week when I was in D.C., he had that whole press conference and he had the media there. And he's like, all right, yeah, immigration reform, comprehensive immigration reform. Yeah, we're down with that. Dreamers, clean dream. Yeah, we're down with it. Anybody that said anything, he would agree with them afterwards. And then the meeting ends. And actually one of the representatives that I spoke with came to me. He's like, all that was a show.
What?
After cameras went out, the real thing started. But and then.
How
it's just the roller coaster you go through. The roller coaster you go. Oh, that's politics. That's
bullshit.
Washington.
I hate that. So
the roller coaster you go through, like, they're like, all right, DACA, yes, no, yes. They just keep you back and forth. But anyways, like, I don't want to get way into it. You know, I just want to say that, like, people that are listening, the way you can support is if you call your congressional members and when you meet people that are going through this struggle, really try to empathize with them, hear out their stories, even if it makes you a little uncomfortable, you know, because I will say this, and I tried to tell this to one of the congressional members I met, who was a Democrat, and I said, look, he was talking about if we shut down the government, how bad it'll look, we'll lose support, you'll lose support. And I was like, you know what, who's going to look back on history we're going to be on the right side of history. Mm-hmm. Who's going to look back and be like, oh, damn, those Democrats, they shut down government to give those kids their rights? Who looked back on the 60s and said, oh, God, those Democrats standing with the black kids, right?
Yeah.
You know, so I'm like, you know, this is our civil movement. We have our own movement here. You know, and another thing I'm doing, and for all my PQ people, if you're listening, I have a art show coming up in February 16 in Barrio Logan at the Bread and Salt Gallery, where all my
San Diego.
It's in San Diego.
Okay.
And Shireen's coming now. She
now I have to.
Now she has to put her blast right here. But it's I'm donating a lot of my pieces, and I have different artists that support the movement are donating their pieces, and 100% of proceeds go to advocating for the Dream Act and bringing about a comprehensive, long lasting, permanent solution for my brothers and sisters that are in the position that I am in. So if anybody wants to come out and support us in that way, and it's not just a fundraiser, it is a celebration of our community, mm-hmm. a celebration of our resiliency, and a celebration of us as human beings. So anybody that comes out, I would love you for that. I would appreciate your support, and thank you guys so much for having me on. You know, I could go on all day.
No, you. But I really appreciate you telling your story and being so open. And I'm glad that we got to educate ourselves about this, and I'm sure our listeners are educated about it too, because
you don't really know until you talk to someone who's experienced it.
Yeah.
Cause you can hear it enough. Like, oh, these kids, they have nothing. You know, they don't want to go to a country they never even lived in.
Yeah. And
it's wild. It's wild out
and
here.
And we're all just people trying our best, and we're not defined by papers. I think you have to remember that.
It's one thing to hear it 1,000 miles away, but it's another thing to have to feel it, hug it, and feel someone's story and really listen to it live and in person.
So one more time, what's the art show called?
So the art show is called Our Dreams Live, and we're playing on the idea of, you know, trying to get this Dream Act passed. And it is in Barrio Logan, which is in Bread and Salt. Shout out to Bread and Salt, which is a gallery that does a lot of community outreach. They are so down with human rights and immigrant rights. And I love them for working with us to get this show together. And if there are any actually artists that want to submit pieces, LA, San Diego, I don't know. I don't care where you're from. As long as you're down with the movement, I want you in this. So anybody that wants to get involved, I don't know how you can contact me.
I can put your info on the Tumblr, and
we'll put it in our description.
So just show your support, be a part of this. I'm telling you will not regret it.
Be on the right side of history, y'all.
Absolutely.
I think we're a little bit over our time, but I'm so happy that we got to talk about
this. My apologies.
I'm not sorry about it, but I am this is a good episode. I didn't have to talk at all.
it's like back when we were talking.
It kind of still goes with my point is to not alienate people.
Please don't.
And push them out and tell them they are not human or just not respected because they are a type of immigrant or a type of color. Is that a way of describing someone?
I just think just remember that you're no better than anyone else, and
no one is better than you.
We're all just human beings, and
your religion doesn't matter. Your color of skin doesn't matter. Nothing. A piece of paper does not matter.
Your place of origin doesn't matter. Where you were born. We're all on Earth trying our best, and more empathy is, I think, the lesson that we have to learn. Everyone has to learn just to empathize.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for listening, and please check out the description and the links.
Yes, and look at our Tumblr for more information about stuff that you can contact Allie and Ian.
Yes, please do. And thank you, ladies, so much for having me on.
Of course.
I really, really appreciate this.
I am always...
I actually had a lot of fun. This is my first podcast. That was really fun.
You're
I see
a
why
natural.
You guys do this.
You're seriously...
You're a good talker. You're
what
my
talker.
Dad would be like... Ali is a good talker.
You have a good voice.
He should
for
be
radio.
A lawyer. He should be a lawyer. Velvet. He should be a politics. He's a very good talker.
You guys should hear my brother. He's on some other level.
Your voice is velvet, and people are going to love you. And this reminds me of high school. You were always a talker. This reminds me of high school.
You're that guy?
She told me, she's like, I haven't seen you in a decade. I don't know if you've changed. I was like, nah, Shireen, I'm the same exact person. Just a little hairier.
Yeah. We're all a little hairier, you know. Okay, well.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you so much. And we'll...
Shireen, you gonna bite that ass?
I bite that ass. Bye.
Cool. I guess me too. Yeah.